When he came to, Mort rolled over, sat up groggily, and turned his wrist to look at his watch. It said 2:15, but of course it must have stopped at that time last night. He had found Tom's scout at mid-morning, and this couldn't be afternoon. He had fainted, and considering the circumstances, that wasn't surprising. No one faints for 3.5 hours. The watch's second hand was making its steady little circle, however. Must have jogged it when I sat up, that's all. But that wasn't all. The sun had changed position and would soon be lost behind the clouds which were filling up the sky. The color of the lake had dulled to a listless chrome. So he had started off fainting or swooning, and then what? Well, it sounded incredible, but he supposed he must have fallen asleep. The last 3 days had been nerve-wracking, and last night he had been sleepless until 3. So call it a combination of mental and physical fatigue. His mind had just pulled the plug. And Shooter! Christ! Shooter said he'd call! He tried to get to his feet, then fell back with a little oof sound of mingled pain and surprise as his left leg buckled under him. It was full of pins and needles, all of them crazily dancing. He must have lain on the goddamn thing. Why hadn't he brought the Buick, for Christ's sake? If Shooter called and Mort wasn't there to take the call, the man might do anything. He lunged to his feet again, and this time made it all the way up. But when he tried to stride on the left leg, it refused his weight and spilled him forward again. He almost hit his head on the side of the truck going down and was suddenly looking at himself in one of the hubcaps of the scout. The convex surface made his face look like a grotesque funhouse mask. At least he had left the goddamn hat back at the house. If he'd seen that on his head, Mort thought he would have screamed. He wouldn't have been able to help himself. All at once, he remembered there were 2 dead men in the scout. They were sitting above him, getting stiff, and there were tools sticking out of their heads. He crawled out of the scout shadow, dragged his left leg across his right with his hands, and began to pound at it with his fists like a man trying to tenderize a cheap cut of meat. "Stop it!" a small voice cried. It was the last kernel of rationality at his command, a little sane light in what felt like a vast bank of black thunderheads between his ears. "Stop it! He said he'd call late in the afternoon, and it's only 2:15. Plenty of time." But what if he called early? Or what if late afternoon started after 2 o'clock in the deep dish Cracker Barrel South? Keep beating on your leg like that, and you'll wind up with a Charlie horse. Then you can see how you like trying to crawl back in time to take his call. That did the trick. He was able to make himself stop. This time he got up more cautiously and just stood for a moment. He was careful to keep his back to Tom's scout. He did not want to look inside again. Before trying to walk, he found that the pins and needles were subsiding. He walked with a pronounced limp at first, but his gait began to smooth out after the first 12 strides. He was almost clear of the bushes Shooter had stripped and beaten down with Tom's scout when he heard a car approaching. Mort dropped to his knees without even thinking about it and watched as a rusty old Cadillac swept by. It belonged to Don Bassinger, who owned a place on the far side of the lake. Bassinger, a veteran alcoholic who spent most of his time drinking up what remained of his once substantial inheritance, often used Lake Drive as a shortcut to what was known as Bassinger Road. Don was about the only year-round resident down here, Mort thought. After the caddy was out of sight, Mort got to his feet and hurried the rest of the way up to the road. Now he was glad he hadn't brought the Buick. He knew Don Bassinger's Cadillac, and Bassinger knew Mort's Buick. It was probably too early in the day for Don to be in a blackout, and he might well have remembered seeing Mort's car, if it had been there, parked not far from the place where, before too much longer, someone was going to make an extremely horrible discovery. "He's busy tying you to this business," Mort thought as he limped along Lake Drive toward his house. "He's been doing it all along. If anyone saw a car near Tom Greenleaf's last night, it will almost certainly turn out to be your Buick. He killed him with your tools." "I could get rid of the tools," he thought suddenly. "I could throw them in the lake. I might heave up a time or two getting them out, but I think I could go through with it. Could you? I wonder. And even if you did, well, Shooter almost certainly will have thought of that possibility, too. He seems to have thought of all the others. And he knows that if you tried to get rid of the hatchet and the screwdriver and the police dragged the bottom for them and they were found, things would look even worse for you. Do you see what he's done? Do you?" Yes. He saw. John Shooter had given him a present. It was a tar baby. A large, glistening Tara Baby. Mort had smacked the Tara Baby in the head with his left hand, and it had stuck fast. So he had whopped that old Tara Baby in the gut with his right hand to make it let go. Only his right hand had stuck too. He had been, what was the word he had kept using with such smug satisfaction? Disingenuous, wasn't it? Yes, that was it. And all the time he had been getting more entangled with John Shooter's Tara Baby. And now, well, he had told lies to all sorts of people, and that would look bad if it came out. And a quarter of a mile behind him, a man was wearing a hatchet for a hat, and Mort's name was written on the handle, and that would look even worse. Mort imagined the telephone ringing in the empty house and forced himself into a trot. Shooter didn't call. The minutes stretched out like taffy, and Shooter didn't call. Mort walked restlessly through the house, twirling and pulling at his hair. He imagined this was what it felt like to be a junkie waiting for the pusher man. Twice he had second thoughts about waiting, and went to the phone to call the authorities, not old Dave Newsom, or even the county sheriff, but the state police. He would hew to the old Vietnam axiom, kill 'em all and let God sort 'em out. Why not? He had a good reputation, after all. He was a respected member of two main communities, and John Shooter was a... Just what was Shooter? The word phantom came to mind. The word will-o'-the-wisp also came to mind. But it was not this that stopped him. What stopped him was a horrible certainty that Shooter would be trying to call while Mort himself was using the line, that Shooter would hear the busy signal hang up and Mort would never hear from him again. At 3:45, it began to rain, a steady fall rain, cold and gentle, sighing down from a white sky, tapping on the roof and the stiff leaves around the house. At 10:10, the telephone rang. Mort leaped for it. It was Amy. Amy wanted to talk about the fire. Amy wanted to talk about how unhappy she was, not just for herself, but for both of them. Amy wanted to tell him that Fred Evans, the insurance investigator, was still in Derry, still picking over the site, still asking questions about everything from the most recent wiring inspection to who had the keys to the wine cellar, and Ted was suspicious of his motives. Amy wanted Mort to wonder with her if things would have been different if they had had children. Mort responded to all this as best he could. And all the time he was talking with her, he felt time, prime late afternoon time, slipping away. He was half mad with worry that Shooter would call, find the line busy, and commit some fresh atrocity. Finally, he said the only thing he could think of to get her off the line, that if he didn't get to the bathroom soon, he was going to have an accident. "Is it booze?" she asked, concerned. "Have you been drinking?" "Breakfast, I think," he said. "Listen, Amy, I..." "At Bowie's?" "Yes," he said, trying to sound strangled with pain and effort. The truth was he felt strangled. It was all quite a comedy, when you really considered it. "Amy, really, I..." "God, Mort, she keeps the dirtiest grill in town," Amy said. "Go. I'll call back later." The phone went dead in his ear. He put the receiver into its cradle, stood there a moment, and was amazed and dismayed to discover his fictional complaint was suddenly real. His bowels had drawn themselves into an aching, throbbing knot. He ran for the bathroom, unclasping his belt as he went. It was a near thing, but he made it. He sat on the ring in the rich odor of his own wastes, his pants around his ankles catching his breath. And the phone began to ring again. He sprang up like a jack released from its box, cracking one knee smartly on the side of the washstand, and ran for it, holding his pants up with one hand and mincing along like a girl in a tight skirt. He had that miserable, embarrassing, I didn't have time to wipe feeling, and he guessed it happened to everyone. But it suddenly occurred to him he had never read about it in a book. Not one single book. Ever. Oh, life was such a comedy. This time, it was Shooter.
"I saw you down there," Shooter said. His voice was as calm and serene as ever. "Down where I left 'em, I mean. Looked like you had a heat stroke. Only it didn't somehow. What do you want?
Mort switched the telephone to his other ear. His pants slid down to his ankles again. He let them go and stood there with a waistband of his jockey shorts suspended halfway between his knees and his hips. What an author photograph this would make, he thought.
I almost pinned a note on you, Shooter said. I decided not to.
He paused, then added with a kind of absent contempt,
you scare too easy.
What do you want?
Well, I told you that already, Mr. Rainey. I want a story to make up for the one you stole. Ain't you ready to admit it yet?
Yes. Tell him yes. Tell him anything. The earth is flat. John Kennedy and Elvis Presley are alive and well and playing banjo duets in Cuba. Meryl Streep's a transvestite. Tell him anything.
But he wouldn't. All the fury and frustration and horror and confusion suddenly burst out of his mouth in a howl.
I didn't! I didn't! You're crazy, and I can prove it! I have the magazine, you loony! Do you hear me? I have the goddamn magazine!
The response to this was no response. The line was silent and dead, without even the faraway gabble of a phantom voice to break that smooth darkness, like that which crept up to the window wall each night he had spent here alone.
Shooter?
Silent.
Shooter, are you still there?
More silent. He was gone. Mort let the telephone sag away from his ear. He was returning it to the cradle when Shooter's voice, tinny and distant and almost lost, said,
now?
Mort put the phone back to his ear. It seemed to weigh 800 pounds.
What? He asked. I thought you were gone.
You have it. You have this so-called magazine now? He thought Shooter sounded upset for the first time. Upset and unsure.
No, Mort said.
Well, there, Shooter said, sounding relieved. I think you might finally be ready to talk to...
It's coming Federal Express, Mort interrupted. It will be at the post office by 10 tomorrow.
What will be? Shooter asked. Some fuzzy old thing that's supposed to be a copy?
No, Mort said. The feeling that he had rocked the man, that he had actually gotten past his defenses and hit him hard enough to make it hurt, was strong and undeniable. For a moment or two, Shooter had sounded almost afraid, and Mort was angrily glad. The magazine. The actual magazine.
There was another long pause, but this time Mort kept the telephone screwed tightly against his ear. Shooter was there, and suddenly the story was the central issue again, the story and the accusation of plagiarism. Shooter treating him like he was a goddamn college kid was the issue, and maybe the man was on the run at last.
Once in the same parochial school where Mort had learned the trick of swallowing crooked, he had seen a boy stick a pin in a beetle which had been trundling across his desk. The beetle had been caught, pinned, wriggling, and dying. At the time, Mort had been sad and horrified. Now he understood. Now he only wanted to do the same thing to this man, this crazy man.
There can't be any magazine, Shooter said finally. Not with that story in it. That story is mine.
Mort could hear anguish in the man's voice, real anguish. It made him glad the pin was in Shooter. He was wriggling around on it. It'll be here at 10 tomorrow, Mort said, or as soon after as FedEx drops the Tashmore stuff. I'll be happy to meet you there. You can take a look, as long a look as you want, you goddamn maniac.
Not there, Shooter said after another pause. At your house.
Forget it. When I show you that issue of Ellery Queen, I want to be someplace where I can yell for help if you go ape shit.
You'll do it my way, Shooter said.
He sounded a little more in control, but Mort did not believe Shooter had even half the control he'd had previously.
If you don't, I'll see you in the Maine State Prison for murder.
Don't make me laugh, but Mort felt his bowels begin to knot up again.
I hooked you to those two men in more ways than you know, Shooter said, and you have told a right smart of lies. And I just disappear, Mr. Rainey. You're going to find yourself standing with your head in a noose and your feet in Crisco. You don't scare me. Yeah, I do, Shooter said. He spoke almost gently. The only thing is, you're starting to scare me a little too. I can't quite figure you out. Mort was silent. It'd be funny, Shooter said in a strange, ruminating tone, if we'd come by the same story in two different places, at two different times. The thought had occurred to me. Did it? I dismissed it, Mort said. Too much of a coincidence. If it was just the same plot, that would be one thing, but the same language, the same goddamn diction. Uh-huh, Shooter said. I thought the same thing, Pilgrim. It's just too much. Coincidence is out. You stole it from me, all right. But I'm goddamned if I can figure out how or when. Oh, quit it, Mort burst out. I have the magazine. I have proof. Don't you understand that? It's over. Whether it was some nutty game on your part or just a delusion, it's over. I have the magazine. After a long silence, Shooter said, not yet, you don't. How true, Mort said. He felt a sudden and totally unwanted sense of kinship with the man. So, what do we do tonight? Why, nothing, Shooter said. Those men will keep. One has a wife and kids visiting family. The other lives alone. You go and get your magazine. Tomorrow morning I'll come to your place around noon. You'll kill me, Mort said. He found that the idea didn't carry much terror with it. Not tonight, anyway. If I show you the magazine, your delusion will break down, and you'll kill me. No, Shooter replied. And this time he seemed clearly surprised. You? No, sir. But those others were going to get in the way of our business. I couldn't have that. And I saw that I could use them to make you deal with me, to face up to your responsibility. You're crafty, Mort said. I'll give you that. I believe you're nuts, but I also believe you're just about the craftiest son of a bitch I ever ran across in my life. Well, you can believe this, Shooter said. If I come tomorrow and find you gone, Mr. Rainey, I will make it my business to destroy every person in the world that you love and care for. I will burn your life like a cane field in a high wind. You will go to jail for killing those two men, but going to jail will be the least of your sorrows. Do you understand? Yes, Mort said. I understand, Pilgrim. Then you be there. And suppose, just suppose, I show you the magazine, and it has my name on the contents page and my story inside. What then? There was a short pause. Then Shooter said, I go to the authorities and confess to the whole shooting match. But I'd take care of myself long before the trial, Mr. Rainey. Because if things turn out that way, then I suppose that I am crazy. And that kind of a crazy man, there was a sigh. That kind of a crazy man has no excuse or reason to live. The words struck Mort with queer force. He's unsure, he thought. For the first time, he's really unsure, which is more than I've ever been. But he cut that off, and hard. He had never had a reason to be unsure. This was Shooter's fault. Every bit of it was Shooter's fault. He said, how do I know you won't claim the magazine as a fake? He expected no response to this, except maybe something about how Mort would have to take his word, but Shooter surprised him. If it's real, I'll know, he said. And if it's fake, we'll both know. I don't reckon you could have rigged a whole fake magazine in 3 days, no matter how many people you got working for you in New York. It was Mort's turn to think, and he thought for a long, long time. Shooter waited for him. I'm going to trust you, Mort said at last. I don't know why, for sure. Maybe because I don't have a lot to live for myself these days. But I'm not going to trust you whole hog. You come down here. Stand in the driveway where I can see you and see that you're unarmed. I'll come out. Is that satisfactory?
That'll do her.
God help us both.
Yes, sir. I'll be damned if I'm sure what I'm into anymore. And that is not a comfortable feeling.
Shooter.
Right here.
I want you to answer one question.
Silence.
But an inviting silence,
Mort thought.
Did you burn down my house in Derry?
No, Shooter said at once. I was keeping an eye on you.
And Bump, Mort said bitterly.
Listen, Shooter said. You get my hat?
Yes.
I want it, Shooter said. One way or the other.
And the line went dead. Just like that. Mort put the phone down slowly and carefully and walked back to the bathroom, once again holding his pants up as he went to finish his business. Amy did call back around 7, and this time Mort was able to talk to her quite normally, just as if the bathroom upstairs wasn't trashed and there weren't two dead men sitting behind a screen of bushes on the path down to the lake, stiffening as the twilight turned dark around them. She had spoken with Fred Evans herself since her last call, she said, and she was convinced either he knew something or suspected something about the fire he didn't want to tell them. Mort tried to soothe her and thought he succeeded to some degree, but he was worried himself. If Shooter hadn't started the fire, and Mort felt inclined to believe the man had been telling the truth about that, then it must have been raw coincidence. Right? He didn't know if it was right or not. Mort, I've been so worried about you, she said suddenly. That snapped him back from his thoughts. Me? I'm okay.
Are you sure? When I saw you yesterday, I thought you looked strained. She paused. In fact, I thought you looked like you did before you had the... You know.
Amy, I did not have a nervous breakdown.
Well, no, she said quickly. But you know what I mean. When the movie people were being so awful about the Delacorte family.
That had been one of the bitterest experiences of Mort's life. Paramount had optioned the book for $75,000 on a pickup price of $750,000. Damn big money. And they had been on the verge of exercising their option when someone had turned up an old script in the file, something called The Home Team, which was enough like the Delacorte family to open up potential legal problems. It was the only time in his career, before this nightmare anyway, when he had been exposed to the possibility of a plagiarism charge. The execs had ended up letting the option lapse at the 11th hour. Mort still did not know if they had been really worried about plagiarism, or had simply had second thoughts about his novel's film potential. If they really had been worried, he didn't know how such a bunch of pansies could make any movies. Herb Creekmore had obtained a copy of the Home Team screenplay, and Mort had seen only the most casual similarity. Amy agreed. The fuss happened just as he was reaching a dead end on a novel he had wanted desperately to write. There had been a short PR tour for the paperback version of the Delacorte family at the same time. All of that at once had put him under a great deal of strain. But he had not had a nervous breakdown.
I'm okay, he insisted again, speaking gently.
He had discovered an amazing and rather touching thing about Amy some years before. If you spoke to her gently enough, she was apt to believe you about almost anything. He had often thought that if it had been a species-wide trait, like showing your teeth to indicate rage or amusement, wars would have ceased millennia ago.
Are you sure, Mort?
Yes. Call me if you hear any more from our insurance friend.
I will.
He paused. Are you at Ted's?
Yes.
How do you feel about him these days?
She hesitated. Then said simply, I love him.
Oh. I didn't go with other men, she said suddenly. I've always wanted to tell you that. I didn't go with other men. But Ted, he looked past your name and saw me, Mort. He saw me.
You mean I didn't?
You did, when you were here, she said. Her voice sounded small and forlorn. But you were gone so much.
His eyes widened, and he was instantly ready to do battle. Righteous battle. What? I haven't been on tour since the Delacorte family, and that was a short one.
I don't want to argue with you, Mort, she said softly. That part should be over. All I'm trying to say is that even when you were here, you were gone a lot. You had your own lover, you know. Your work was your lover.
Her voice was steady, but he sensed tears buried deep inside it.
How I hated that bitch, Mort. She was prettier than me, smarter than me, more fun than me. How could I compete?
Blame it all on me. Why not? He asked her, dismayed to find himself on the edge of tears. What did you want me to do? Become a goddamn plumber? We would have been poor and I would have been unemployed. There was nothing else I could fucking do. Don't you understand that? There was nothing else I could do.
He had hoped the tears were over, at least for a while, but here they were. Who had rubbed this horrible magic lamp again? Had it been him or her this time?
I'm not blaming you. There's blame for me, too. You never would have found us the way you did if I hadn't been weak and cowardly. It wasn't Ted. Ted wanted us to go to you and tell you together. He kept asking, and I kept putting him off. I told him I wasn't sure. I told myself I still loved you, that things could go back to the way they were, but things never do, I guess.
She caught her breath, and Mort realized she was crying too.
I'll never forget the look on your face when you opened the door of that motel. I'll carry that to my grave.
Good, he wanted to cry out at her. Good. Because you only had to see it. I had to wear it.
You knew my love, he said unsteadily.
I never hid her from you. You knew from the start.
But I never knew, she said, how deep her embrace could be.
Well, cheer up, Mort said. She seems to have left me now. Amy was weeping.
Mort. Mort, I only want you to live and be happy. Can't you see that? Can't you do that?
What he had seen was one of her bare shoulders, touching one of Ted Milner's bare shoulders. He had seen their eyes, wide and frightened, and Ted's hair stuck up in an alfalfa corkscrew. He thought of telling her this, of trying anyway, and let it go. It was enough. They had hurt each other enough. Another time, perhaps, they could go at it again. He wished she hadn't said that thing about the nervous breakdown, though. He had not had a nervous breakdown. Amy, I think I ought to go.
Yes, both of us. Ted's out showing a house, but he'll be back soon. I have to put some dinner together.
I'm sorry about the argument.
Will you call me if you need me? I'm still worried.
Yes, he said. And said goodbye, and hung up. He stood there by the telephone for a moment, thinking he would surely burst into tears. But it passed. That was perhaps the real horror. It passed.
The steadily falling rain made him feel listless and stupid. He made a little fire in the wood stove, drew a chair over, and tried to read the current issue of Harper's. But he kept nodding off and then jerking awake again as his chin dropped, squeezing his windpipe and producing a snore.
I should have bought some cigarettes today, he thought. A few smokes would have kept me awake.
But he hadn't bought any smokes, and he wasn't really sure they would have kept him awake anyway. He wasn't just tired. He was suffering from shock. At last he walked over to the couch, adjusted the pillows, and lay back. Next to his cheek, cold rain, spickle-spackled against the dark glass.
Only once, he thought. I only did it once. And then he fell deeply asleep.
In his dream, he was in the world's biggest classroom. The walls stretched up for miles. Each desk was a mesa, the gray tiles the endless plain which swept among them. The clock on the wall was a huge cold sun. The door to the hallway was shut, but Morton Rainey could read the words on the pebbled glass. Home team writing room. Professor Delacorte.
They spelled it wrong, Mort thought. Too many L's.
But another voice told him this was not so. Mort was standing on the giant blackboard's wide chalk gutter, stretching up. He had a piece of chalk the size of a baseball bat in his hand. He wanted to drop his arm, which ached ferociously, but he could not. Not until he had written the same sentence on the blackboard 500 times. I will not copy from John Kintner. He must have written it 400 times already, he thought. But 400 wasn't enough. Stealing a man's work when a man's work was really all he had was unforgivable. So he would have to write and write and write, and never mind the voice in his mind trying to tell him that this was a dream, that his right arm ached for other reasons. The chalk squeaked monstrously. The dust, acrid and somehow familiar, so familiar, sifted down into his face. At last, he could go on no longer. His arm dropped to his side like a bag filled with lead shot. He turned on the chalk gutter and saw that only one of the desks in the huge classroom was occupied. The occupant was a young man with a country kind of face, a face you expected to see in the North 40 behind the ass end of a mule. His pale brown hair stuck up in spikes from his head. His country cousin hands, seemingly all knuckles, were folded on the desk before him. He was looking at Mort with pale, absorbed eyes.
I know you, Mort said in the dream. That's right, Pilgrim, John Kintner said in his bald, drawling southern accent. You just put me together wrong. Now keep on writing. It's not 500. It's 5,000.
Mort started to turn, but his foot slipped on the edge of the gutter, and suddenly he was spilling outward, screaming into the dry, chalky air, and John Kintner was laughing, and he woke up on the floor, with his head almost underneath the rogue coffee table, clutching at the carpet and crying out in high-pitched, whinnying shrieks. He was at Tashmore Lake. Not in some weird Cyclopean classroom, but at the lake, and dawn was coming up misty in the east.
I'm all right. It was just a dream, and I'm all right.
But he wasn't, because it hadn't just been a dream. John Kintner had been real. How in God's name could he have forgotten John Kintner? Mort had gone to college at Bates and had majored in creative writing. Later, when he spoke to classes of aspiring writers, a chore he ducked whenever possible, he told them that such a major was probably the worst mistake a man or woman could make if he or she wanted to write fiction for a living. Get a job with the post office, he'd say. It worked for Faulkner, and they would laugh. They liked to listen to him, and he supposed he was fairly good at keeping them entertained. That seemed very important, since he doubted that he or anyone else could teach them how to write creatively. Still, he was always glad to get out at the end of the class or seminar or workshop. The kids made him nervous. He supposed John Kintner was the reason why. Had Kintner been from Mississippi? Mort couldn't remember, but he didn't think so. But he had been from some enclave of the Deep South all the same, Alabama, Louisiana, maybe the Tulies of North Florida. He didn't know for sure. Bates College had been a long time ago, and he hadn't thought of John Kintner, who had suddenly dropped out one day for reasons known only to himself in years.
That's not true. You thought about him last night. Dreamed about him, you mean?
Mort corrected himself quickly. But that hellish little voice inside would not let it go.
No, earlier than that, you thought about him while you were talking to Shooter on the telephone.
He didn't want to think about this. He wouldn't think about this. John Kintner was in the past. John Kintner had nothing to do with what was happening now. He got up and walked unsteadily toward the kitchen in the milky early light to make strong coffee. Lots and lots of strong coffee. Except the hellish little voice wouldn't let him be. Mort looked at Amy's set of kitchen knives hanging from their magnetized steel runners and thought that if he could cut that little voice out, he would try the operation immediately. You were thinking that you rocked the man, that you finally rocked him. You were thinking that the story had become the central issue again, the story and the accusation of plagiarism. Shooter treating you like a goddamn college kid was the issue, like a goddamn college kid, like a shut up, Mort said hoarsely. Just shut the fuck up. The voice did. But he found himself unable to stop thinking about John Kintner anyway. As he measured coffee with a shaking hand, he thought of his constant strident protestations that he hadn't plagiarized Shooter's story, that he had never plagiarized anything. But he had, of course. Once. Just once. But that was so long ago, he whispered. And it doesn't have anything to do with this. It might be true, but that did not stop his thoughts. He had been a junior, and it was spring semester. The creative writing class of which he was a part was focusing on the short story that semester. The teacher was a fellow named Richard Perkins, Jr., who had written two novels which had gotten very good reviews and sold very few copies. Mort had tried one and thought the good reviews and bad sales had the same root cause. The books were incomprehensible. But the man hadn't been a bad teacher. He had kept them entertained, at least. There had been about a dozen students in the class. One of them was John Kintner. Kintner was only a freshman, but he had gotten special permission to take the class. And had deserved it, Mort supposed. Southern fried cracker or not, that sucker had been good. The course required each of them to write either six short stories or three longer ones. Each week, Perkins dittoed off the ones he thought would make for the liveliest discussion and handed them out at the end of the class. The students were supposed to come the following week prepared to discuss and criticize. It was the usual way to run such a class. And one week Perkins had given them a story by John Kintner. It had been called... What had it been called? Mort had turned on the water to fill the coffee maker, but now he only stood, looking absently out at the fog beyond the window wall and listening to the running water. You know damn well what it was called. Secret Window, Secret Garden. But it wasn't, he yelled petulantly to the empty house. He thought furiously, determined to shut the hellish little voice up once and for all. And suddenly, it came to him. Crowfoot Mile, he shrieked. The name of the story was Crowfoot Mile, and it doesn't have anything to do with anything. Except that was not quite true, either. And he didn't really need the little voice hunkered down someplace in the middle of his aching head to point out the fact. Kintner had turned in three or maybe four stories before disappearing to wherever he had disappeared to. If asked to guess, Mort would have guessed Vietnam. It was where most of them had disappeared to at the end of the 60s, the young men, anyhow. Crowfoot Mile hadn't been the best of Kintner's stories, but it had been good. Kintner was clearly the best writer in Richard Perkins Jr.'s class. Perkins treated the boy almost as an equal. And in Mort Rainey's not-so-humble estimation, Perkins had been right to do so, because he thought Kintner had been quite a bit better than Richard Perkins, Jr. As far as that went, Mort believed he had been better. But had he been better than Kintner?
Uh-uh, he said under his breath as he turned on the coffee maker. I was second. Yes, he had been second, and he had hated that. He knew that most students taking writing courses were just marking time, pursuing a whim before giving up childish things and settling into a study of whatever it was that would be their real life's work. The creative writing most of them would do in later life would consist of contributing items to the community calendar pages of their local newspapers, or writing advertising copy for Bright Blue Breeze dish detergent. Mort had come into Perkins' class confidently expecting to be the best, because it had never been any other way with him. For that reason, John Kintner had come as an unpleasant shock. He remembered trying to talk to the boy once, but Kintner, who contributed in class only when asked, had proved to be almost inarticulate. When he spoke out loud, he mumbled and stumbled like a poor white sharecropper's boy whose education had stopped at the fourth grade level. His writing was the only voice he had, apparently. And you stole it. Shut up, he muttered, just shut up. You were second best, and you hated it. You were glad when he was gone, because then you could be first again, just like you always had been. Yes, true. And a year later, when he was preparing to graduate, he had been cleaning out the back closet of the sleazy Lewiston apartment he had shared with two other students, and had come upon a pile of off-prints from Perkins' writing course. Only one of Kintner's stories had been in the stack. It happened to be Crowfoot Mile. He remembered sitting on the seedy, beer-smelling rug of his bedroom, reading the story, and the old jealousy had come over him again. He threw the other off-prints away, but he had taken that one with him, for reasons he wasn't sure he wanted to examine closely. As a sophomore, Mort had submitted a story to a literary magazine called Aspen Quarterly. It came back with a note which said the readers had found it quite good, although the ending seemed rather jejun. The note, which Mort found both patronizing and tremendously exciting, invited him to submit other material. Over the next 2 years, he had submitted 4 more stories. None were accepted, but a personal note accompanied each of the rejection slips. Mort went through an unpublished writer's agony of optimism, alternating with deep pessimism. He had days when he was sure it was only a matter of time before he cracked Aspen Quarterly. And he had days when he was positive that the entire editorial staff, pencil-neck geeks to a man, was only playing with him, teasing him the way a man might tease a hungry dog by holding a piece of meat up over its head, and then jerking the scrap out of reach when it leaps. He sometimes imagined one of them holding up one of his manuscripts fresh out of its manila envelope and shouting, "Here's another one from that putz in Maine. Who wants to write the letter this time?" And all of them cracking up, perhaps even rolling around on the floor under their posters of Joan Baez and Moby Grape at the Fillmore. Most days, Mort had not indulged in this sort of sad paranoia. He understood that he was good, and that it was only a matter of time. And that summer, working as a waiter in a Rockland restaurant, he thought of the story by John Kintner. He thought it was probably still in his trunk, kicking around at the bottom. He had a sudden idea. He would change the title and submit Crowfoot Mile to Aspen Quarterly under his own name. He remembered thinking it would be a fine joke on them, although looking back now, he could not imagine what the joke would have been. He did remember that he'd had no intention of publishing the story under his own name, or if he had had such an intention on some deeper level, he hadn't been aware of it. In the unlikely event of an acceptance, he would withdraw the story, saying he wanted to work on it some more. And if they rejected it, he could at least take some cheer in the thought that John Kintner wasn't good enough for Aspen Quarterly either. So he had sent the story, and they had accepted it. And he had let them accept it. And they sent him a check for $25, an honorarium, the accompanying letter had called it. And then they had published it. And Morton Rainey, overcome by belated guilt at what he had done, had cashed the check, and had stuffed the bills into the poor box of St. Catherine's in Augusta one day. But guilt hadn't been all he'd felt. Oh, no. Mort sat at the kitchen table with his head propped in one hand, waiting for the coffee to perk. His head ached. He didn't want to be thinking about John Kintner and John Kintner's story.
What he had done with Crowfoot Mile had been one of the most shameful events of his life. Was it really surprising that he had buried it for so many years? He wished he could bury it again now. This, after all, was going to be a big day. Maybe the biggest of his life. Maybe even the last of his life. He should be thinking about going to the post office. He should be thinking about his confrontation with Shooter. But his mind would not let that sad old time alone. When he'd seen the magazine, the actual magazine with his name in it, above John Kintner's story, he felt like a man waking from a horrible episode of sleepwalking, an unconscious outing in which he has done some irrevocable thing. How had he let it go so far? It was supposed to have been a joke, for Christ's sakes, just a little giggle. But he had let it go so far. The story had been published, and there were at least a dozen other people in the world who knew it wasn't his, including Kintner himself. And if one of them happened to pick up Aspen Quarterly, he himself told no one, of course. He simply waited, sick with terror. He slept and ate very little that late summer and early fall. He lost weight, and dark shadows brushed themselves under his eyes. His heart began to trip hammer every time the telephone rang. If the call was for him, he would approach the instrument with dragging feet and cold sweat on his brow. Sure, it would be Kintner, and the first words out of Kintner's mouth would be, "You stole my story, and something has got to be done about it. I think I'll start by telling everybody what kind of thief you are." The most incredible thing was this. He had known better. He had known the possible consequences of such an act for a young man who hoped to make a career of writing. It was like playing Russian roulette with a bazooka. Yet still. But as that fall slipped uneventfully past, he began to relax a little. The issue of Aspen Quarterly had been replaced by a new issue. The issue was no longer lying out on tables in library periodical rooms all over the country. It had been tucked away into the stacks or transferred to microfiche. It might still cause trouble. He bleakly supposed he would have to live with that possibility for the rest of his life. But in most cases, out of sight meant out of mind. Then, in November of that year, a letter from Aspen Quarterly came. Mort held it in his hands, looking at his name on the envelope, and began to shake all over. His eyes filled with some liquid that felt too hot and corrosive to be tears, and the envelope first doubled and then trebled. Caught. They caught me. They'll want me to respond to a letter they have from Kintner or Perkins or one of the others in the class. I'm caught. He had thought of suicide then, quite calmly and quite rationally. His mother had sleeping pills. He would use those. Somewhat eased by this prospect, he tore the envelope open and pulled out a single sheet of stationery. He held it folded in one hand for a long moment and considered burning it without even looking at it. He wasn't sure he could stand to see the accusation held baldly up in front of him. He thought it might drive him mad. "Go ahead, damn it. Look. The least you can do is look at the consequences. You may not be able to stand up to them, but you can, by God, look at them." He unfolded the letter. "Dear Mort Rainey, your short story, Eye of the Crow, was extremely well received here. I'm sorry this follow-up letter has been so slow in coming, but frankly, we expected to hear from you. You have been so faithful in your submissions over the years that your silence now that you have finally succeeded in making it is a little perplexing. If there was anything about the way your story was handled, typesetting, design, placement, etc., that you didn't like, we hope you'll bring it up. Meantime, how about another tale? Respectfully yours, Charlie. Charles Palmer, Assistant Editor." Mort had read this letter twice, and then began to peal hoarse bursts of laughter at the house, which was luckily empty. He had heard of side-splitting laughter, and this was surely it. He felt that if he didn't stop soon, his sides really would split and send his guts spewing out all over the floor. He had been ready to kill himself with his mother's sleeping pills, and they wanted to know if he was upset with the way the story had been typeset. He had expected to find out that his career was ruined even before it was fairly begun, and they wanted more. More! He laughed, howled actually, until his side-splitting laughter turned to hysterical tears. Then he sat on the sofa, reread Charles Palmer's letter, and cried until he laughed again. At last he had gone into his room and lain down with the pillows arranged behind him just the way he liked, and then he had fallen asleep. He had gotten away with it. That was the upshot. He had gotten away with it, and he had never done anything even remotely like it again. And it had all happened about 1,000 years ago. And so why had it come back to haunt him now? He didn't know, but he intended to stop thinking about it. And right now, too, he told the empty room, and walked briskly over to the coffee maker, trying to ignore his aching head. You know why you're thinking about it now. Shut up. He spoke in a conversational tone which was rather cheery, but his hands were shaking as he picked up the Silex. Some things you can't hide forever. You might be ill, Mort. Shut up. I'm warning you, he said in his cheery conversational voice. You might be very ill. In fact, you might be having a nervous breakdown. Shut up! He cried, and threw the Silex as hard as he could. It sailed over the counter, flew across the room, turning over and over as it went, crunched into the window wall, shattered, and fell dead on the floor. He looked at the window wall and saw a long, silvery crack zigzagging up to the top. It started at the place where the Silex had impacted. He felt very much like a man who might have a similar crack running right through the middle of his brain. But the voice had shut up. He walked stolidly into the bedroom, got the alarm clock, and walked back into the living room. He set the alarm for 10:30 as he walked. At 10:30, he was going to go to the post office, pick up his Federal Express package, and go stolidly about the task of putting this nightmare behind him. In the meantime, though, he would sleep. He would sleep on the couch, where he had always slept best. I am not having a nervous breakdown, he whispered to the little voice. But the little voice was having none of the argument. Mort thought that he might have frightened the little voice. He hoped so, because the little voice had certainly frightened him. His eyes found the silvery crack in the window wall and traced it dully. He thought of using the chambermaid's key. How the room had been dim, and it had taken his eyes a moment to adjust. Their naked shoulders. Their frightened eyes. He had been shouting. He couldn't remember what, and had never dared to ask Amy. But it must have been some scary shit, judging from the look in their eyes. If I was ever going to have a nervous breakdown, he thought, looking at the lightning bolt senselessness of the crack, it would have been then. Hell, that letter from Aspen Quarterly was nothing compared to opening a motel room door and seeing your wife with another man, a slick real estate agent from some shit-splat little town in Tennessee. Mort closed his eyes, and when he opened them again, it was because another voice was clamoring. This one belonged to the alarm clock. The fog had cleared. The sun had come out. And it was time to go to the post office. On the way, he became suddenly sure that Federal Express would have come and gone, and Juliet would stand there at the window with her bare face hanging out and shake her head and tell him there was nothing for him, sorry. And his proof? It would be gone like smoke. This feeling was irrational. Herb was a cautious man, one who did not make promises that couldn't be kept. But it was almost too strong to deny. He had to force himself out of the car. And the walk from the door of the post office to the window where Juliet Stoker stood sorting mail seemed at least 1,000 miles long. When he got there, he tried to speak, and no words came out. His lips moved, but his throat was too dry to make the sounds. Juliet looked up at him, then took a step back. She looked alarmed. Not, however, as alarmed as Amy and Ted had looked when he opened the motel room door and pointed the gun at them.
Mr. Rainey, are you all right?
He cleared his throat. Sorry, Juliet, my throat kind of double-clutched on me for a second.
You're very pale, she said.
And he could hear in her voice that tone so many of the Tashmore residents used when they spoke to him. It was a sort of pride, but it held an undertaste of irritation and condescension, as though he was a child prodigy who needed special care and feeding. Something I ate last night, I guess, he said. Did Federal Express leave anything for me?
No, not a thing.
He gripped the underside of the counter desperately, and for a moment thought he would faint, although he had understood almost immediately that that was not what she had said.
Pardon me?
She had already turned away. Her sturdy country bum was presented to him as she shuffled through some packages on the floor.
Just the one thing, I said, she replied,
and then turned around and slid the package across the counter to him. He saw the return address was EQMM in Pennsylvania and felt relief course through him. It felt like cool water pouring down a dry throat.
Thank you.
Welcome. You know, the post office would have a cow if they knew we handled that Federal Express man's mail.
Well, I certainly appreciate it, Mort said. Now that he had the magazine, he felt a need to get away, to get back to the house. This need was so strong it was almost elemental. He didn't know why. It was an hour and a quarter until noon, but it was there. In his distress and confusion, he actually thought of giving Juliet a tip to shut her up. And that would have caused her soul, Yankee to its roots, to rise up in a clamor.
You won't tell him, will you? She asked archly.
No way, he said, managing a grin.
Good, Juliet Stoker said, and smiled.
Because I saw what you did.
He stopped by the door.
Pardon me?
I said they'd shoot me if you did, she said, and looked closely at his face. You ought to go home and lie down, Mr. Rainey. You really don't look well at all.
I feel like I spent the last 3 days lying down, Juliet. The time I didn't spend hitting things, that is.
Well, he said, maybe that's not such a bad idea. I still feel weak.
There's a virus going around. You probably caught it.
Then the two women from Camp Wigmore, the ones everybody in town suspected of being lesbians, albeit discreet ones, came in, and Mort made good his escape. He sat in the Buick with the blue package on his lap, not liking the way everybody kept saying he looked sick, liking the way his mind had been working even less.
It doesn't matter. It's almost over.
He started to pull the envelope open, and then the ladies from Camp Wigmore came back out and looked at him. They put their heads together. One of them smiled. The other laughed out loud. And Mort suddenly decided he would wait until he got back home.